I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tim Peake is not just an astronaut, he's an aquanaut. And he, honestly, Ed looked at me and, what? There's an expression in my very odd world where we say we do a deep dive on somebody to learn a lot about them. Well, little did I know. I think you really are a superhero.
not at all, not if you ask
no,
my
you
wife.
Are. No, you are. What do your kids think? So you've got two boys. Do they know what you've done and what you've seen?
When we were training for the mission, it was interesting because I had take them to work with me, and I thought that's the best way to help them to prepare for what was coming. Yeah. And in Houston, we had all these mock-ups of the whole International Space Station. The Soyuz simulator was there, showed them where I'd be eating my meals, where I'd be sleeping. This is the hatch for spacewalking, these kind of things. And so that helped them become more familiar with where I'd be and what I'd be doing. So that helped. But I don't think it was until the launch day that they truly understood that I was actually, you know, that's me heading up to space.
Going to live in space. That's a lovely way of looking at it. I don't quite understand it as just as a layperson. You lived in space. I mean, it's just, do you ever think back and think, what? Oh, here's some tea. Let's get real. I love that. Tim, you've got your cup of tea now.
Yes, thank you, Gabby.
Astronaut, aquanaut, Tim Peake has a cup of tea. Did you have cup of teas up in space?
I did, yeah. I didn't expect to. I wasn't really sure what we would get in terms of hot drinks. But NASA said, well, you're allowed 3 hot drinks a day. What would you like? I said, oh, well, yeah, 2 teas and a coffee, thanks. I said, what tea do you like? Any particular one? And so I said, well, actually, I like Builder's tea. And, you know, Yorkshire Red Label is my favourite. And they said, well, OK, we'll get in touch and we'll get them tested and we'll get them bagged up and that will be your tea. And sure enough.
Tested?
They have to test them, make sure they're appropriate. And I don't know what exact testing they go through, make sure that they're not going to do any harm and that they're compatible with space station packaging and all the rest of it. And there I was when I arrived on the space station, the foil packets for my tea. But the thing is, of course, it's got creamer in it, no milk. And so it's not quite the same. And you put hot water into this foil pouch and you drink it through a straw. So as soon as you put the hot water in, it's way too hot to drink. So you have to leave it a while. And it's not too bad at the beginning. But then by the end, you're sucking on a tea bag and it's lukewarm. And
ew.
So it's not quite the same experience you might have down here on Earth.
So you can't drink anything because the liquid would fly
around.
Yeah,
you've got
around.
No cups and you know, you're not having cups and saucers, you can't hold anything. Everything's Velcroed to the wall and liquid would fly around. So we drink things with straws and they've got like a clamp at the top of the straws and that just stops any liquid coming out the top of them.
What is it like in space?
There's a question. It's the most surreal experience I've ever had. I love it, being in space. Not everybody does, as in, you know, you're in a hostile environment, you know that you're at a certain element of risk, but it's absolutely beautiful. The Earth is just stunning by day and by night. And then space is just awesome. I mean, the vastness of it. And by daytime, it's completely black. And then by nighttime, all the stars come out and you see the Milky Way rising. You see the aurora, you see thunderstorms over the planet. And all the time, you're floating around. And that in itself is just so much fun. It takes a you know, a bit of a while to get used to it, like any sport really. But as you get used to it, you can fling yourself around the space station flying about in weightlessness, and it's just a huge amount of fun.
I know this is a crazy thing to say, but when you're telling these stories, and you do because you're back on tour again doing talks to everybody, when you tell these stories, do you feel as if you're talking about somebody else? Because does it feel slightly unreal? Because when you talk about it, I believe you because I know you're not a liar and I've seen the pictures, but it feels sort of unbelievable.
Yeah, it is a completely different environment. And I think I've done lots of diving. I love diving. And when you...
That's why I said you're an aquanaut as well.
Yeah. And when you submerge yourself underwater, you enter this new realm and you kind of think, oh, we don't really belong here, but isn't this wonderful, surrounded by marine life and popping down there for a while. And it's a bit like in space. You realise that you don't quite belong and you've gone through this violent launch experience to get you there.
Is it violent?
Really violent, yeah.
In what way?
Just terms of energy and power. I remember it being mind-boggling after about 5 minutes, just thinking, how much longer can this go on for? I mean, you're feeling 4 Gs of acceleration.
So put it into layman's terms then. You say it's violent. In what way? What's happening to you when that's happening?
So physically, you're feeling the acceleration, the G-force, as you lift off the launch pad. To begin with, you're hearing the noise. You're feeling the vibration of the rocket and all the energy that's being expended. And in the initial stages, you're pointing up at the sky. You're just getting as much altitude as quickly as possible. But then for the last 4 or 5 minutes, the rocket's actually horizontal. You're in space, and now you need speed. So you're pointing horizontally, just trying to get up to 25 times the speed of sound. And at some point, if you've ever been on a roller coaster and thought, okay, I'm not sure I should have sat on this. I mean, you're there just thinking, this is crazy. This is absolutely ridiculous. The speed is overwhelming. And so that comes to an abrupt halt, a violent halt. When the engine cuts out, you go from 4 Gs to 0 G in a fraction of a second. And then it's beautiful and quiet, and you float up out of your seat and look out the window, and there's Earth, and it's like you've entered this realm, a different realm, and it's quite remarkable.
Why did you want to do this? I mean, I've done a deep dive, and I've learned that you spent an incredible amount of time underwater, but in one go, and you're an adventurer. But was it something as a child? You know, I think everybody always says, oh, I want to be an astronaut. Oh, I want to be a fireman. Oh, I want to be an actress, whatever it is. Was it something, did you just think, I want to be up there?
I felt I wanted to be up there flying, definitely, from a young age. And I went through a phase of, you know, enjoying space and thinking, wow, you know, aren't astronauts cool? Wouldn't it be great to do that? But it was never serious. And when I was seriously thinking about my career from kind of 13 onwards, it was all about flying. I joined the cadets at school. I'd had a trip in a glider and thought, wow, if I can fly for a living, that's what I want to do. And we didn't have anybody who was a British astronaut to look up to. And it wasn't until 1991 when Helen Sharman first flew, then we had somebody. And that was a one-off commercial mission. So it wasn't like it was, okay, now we can all join the space agency and become astronauts. So even that was a one-off. And so I don't think anybody in the UK really grew up thinking they could be astronauts like they were in America or in Russia when they've been doing this since the late 50s, early 60s. So when the European Space Agency had the selection process in 2008, it was a huge surprise that they said, hey, this is open to all ESA member states, and that includes the UK. You can apply.
It's very different flying an aeroplane or flying a helicopter to going into space.
Yes. Yeah. And I think from that point of view, as my flying career had progressed, I'd become an instructor pilot. Then I became a test pilot. And as a test pilot, I was working much more with industry and pushing aircraft to their limits. We were using new technology, and a lot of the new technology comes from the space industry. So I was much closer to the space industry than I had been before. So I think it was really quite incremental. My career was jumping through these hurdles to get to what was, in the right time, the right place, right qualifications to be an astronaut.
But also, you were an aquanaut. So you spent a vast amount of time underwater in one go.
Why? Well, this was a NASA mission called NEMO, and we were using the underwater environment because it's a bit like weightlessness. Things are neutrally buoyant. So it's not the same as weightlessness, but it's as close as we can get to without leaving the planet. And we were testing out things like an asteroid mission. Our particular mission was simulating a 12-day mission to an asteroid to land on there. How are we going to navigate?
Oh, this is mind-blowing, Tim!
And yes, we were living in this habitat 30 meters down on the ocean floor. And twice a day, we'd be going out with this kind of Jacques Cousteau diving equipment, these, you know, with umbilical cords back to the habitat, simulating a spacewalk and working out, if this was an asteroid, you know, how are we going to hang on to it? How are we going to tether ourselves? How can we collect scientific samples? And all the time communicating back to the coast, which we had a mission control center. And they introduced a 90-second communication delay because if you're going to an asteroid, you're going to be so far away, you're not going to have instant comms. And that in itself was a challenge. Trying to communicate for 12 days with that time delay becomes very, very difficult.
How explain that bit?
Well, you just can't have a conversation. I mean, you pose a question and, you know, you're having to wait 180 seconds before your question arrives. They think of the answer.
Oh, you mean an immediate delay?
Yeah, yeah. So you end up just text messaging, really. It's like a text stream we found out worked best. But in emergency situations, that becomes really critical, really difficult. So we were kind of testing out ways as to how we can communicate with mission control better when we go on these long duration missions. And Mars, which, you know, Mars is not that far away in terms of time.
Do you think it will happen?
I think it'll happen in the next 15 to 20 years.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And you've got up to 20 minutes of time delay with a Mars mission. So the crew are very much by themselves.
Why do you think it's important that we go to Mars? Obviously, I know people talk to you a lot about the environmental impact of going into space. And you have some great answers about that.
Yeah, I mean, oh gosh, there's a lot there to unpack in terms of why. I think for me, the why comes down to three things. It comes down to science, it comes down to inspiration and exploration. So science is amazing, and we are just really scratching the surface. The space station's been occupied for about 20 years now. But in the early days, a lot of that was just building it. And then it was government-funded research, which tends to be fundamental science. So it's the basics of things like fluid physics. And it's really hard to know, you know, when something ends up in your iPhone, that actually that was because it was an experiment that was done on the space shuttle in 1984, and it's taken this long to filter down.
Really?
Things like cameras, camera technology and miniaturization of electronic components and stuff.
Oh.
But what we're doing now is the space station's becoming more commercial, and it's a much faster turnaround. So commercial companies are sponsoring payloads, and now the science is very immediate. So a pharma company might grow a protein crystal on board, like motor neuron disease or Parkinson's, Huntington's, bring it back down to Earth, analyze it, and come up with a drug that can combat that protein crystal. And we're now just seeing the potential for scientific research in microgravity. Basically, it's because you haven't got gravity, so you don't have sedimentation, you don't have fracturing. Anything that's really small or fragile that you want to build here on Earth, very hard to do. If you want to print out a human organ using bioink and a 3D printer, for example, which we are doing here on Earth, very, very difficult. You need some sort of scaffolding structure and it collapses on itself and it's hard to do. In space, you can grow or print perfect 3D structures, which initially might be very, very fragile. Obviously, when they're complete, they've got rigidity, they've got strength. So you can potentially print out a human heart in space and fly it back down for the patient on Earth. So this is the kind of thing that's really exciting. And we're only just scratching the surface of the potential for what we can do in space. So that's the science part. You know, there's loads that I could talk about on the science. Then there's the exploration part. And I get this then becomes a little bit more selfish, I guess, as a species. This is where it's a case of us always having this innate desire to explore what's beyond the next mountain, the forest, the coast, whatever. And, you know, going to the moon, learning more about why the moon is like the Earth and how that can teach us things. Going to Mars, was there once life on Mars? Are there other valuable resources in the solar system that we can help, you know, reduce the burden on planet Earth with the resources that we need for electrification of our cars or potential fuels for future fusion reactors and things like this? So, you know, there's a real desire to explore explore for both the passion of knowing, you know, finding out what's beyond the horizon and also what it might teach us. And then the inspiration thing is to, you know, space is something that's inspired people for years. And I think everybody at some point looks up to the stars and just thinks, that's where we came from, isn't it? You know, we're all part of the universe and I wonder what's out there.
Do you feel differently about the Earth now from seeing it as you did?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. You see how precarious it looks. I hesitate to use the word fragile because the Earth's been through a lot. Mm. You know, it's been through ice ages. It's been through extinction events. It's been through calamities, and there'll be calamities to come. And, you know, one day the sun will explode and Earth will die. But when you look at it against the vast blackness of space right now, you just see how isolated we are. I mean, this is little spaceship Earth here, and it's a big black universe out there. And, you know, there's nothing for a long, long way. So I think that gives you a huge amount of respect for the planet.
I love that you use that word, because I do feel that maybe many people don't respect the planet enough. And hearing you say it like that, it puts it into a completely different perspective.
Yes. Yeah, we've got to look after it. I mean, we're the fragile ones. You know, we're a complex, large organism. We're going to be the first to go. You know, we need to look after the planet and it will look after us.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
A five-year-old asked me to ask you this, so I'm doing it. So this is for you, Tom. Are we really the only people in the world, which I think he means half the world?
Yeah.
Because I said that I was meeting you. He said, we cannot be the only people in the world, because if you look past the world, there's definitely more people.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a firm believer. I know many, many serious scientists, astrophysicists, cosmologists who are firm believers as well. Just statistically, look at the images coming back from the James Webb Space Telescope. They're just unbelievable when we look at other galaxies around. There's about 200 billion stars in our own Milky Way around about, and we think maybe up to 1 or 2 trillion galaxies in the observable universe. It's mind-boggling. And then you think about in our own solar system, there's abundant water, carbon-based molecules, you know, carbon compounds that we know are floating around. We capture them outside on the space station and analyze them. So the seeds of life are everywhere. Water is everywhere. Stars are everywhere, and planets orbiting stars in what we call the Goldilocks zone, the habitable zone where liquid water could exist. They seem to be everywhere as well. We've only really looked in our tiny little neighborhood so far. We found 5,000 planets already. And some of these stars burn a lot longer than our sun will burn. And of course, if you've got time, you've got more time for life to evolve and potentially that life to become much more sophisticated. So I think life is abundant throughout the universe.
I suppose because of what we've been fed through literature and then following on through films and television, that we've all been led to use the word aliens. And I think that's what little children then imagine, and many adults. But it's not, that is probably the wrong word. With you're saying that there is life out there.
Yeah, and you're right. You know, Hollywood's not done us any favours in that respect. We all think of, you know, little green people running around, and who knows what they might be, what different life forms are. You only have to look on this planet, look at the octopus, and how incredibly intelligent that is, and how, when you follow the tree of life back, you know, how early humans and the octopus split apart, and yet they've both developed into intelligent creatures that have clear emotions and sensitivities. And you think that's on planet Earth. What might life have done on another planet? I think, you know, there's a difference between single-celled organisms, bacteria, which are probably far more abundant in the universe. Making that leap to complex multicellular life is going to be more rare. But I absolutely think it's happened in you know, hundreds of thousands of places, if not millions of places.
So when you talk about this, I get the feeling that you are still wide-eyed about what you've been through. Do you miss it up there?
I do miss it, yes. Yeah. No, I think I'm lucky that, you know, I flew to space in an era that we have video cameras, photographs.
Yes. And so you really, you know, did do it.
I did it. And I can enjoy looking back at that as well. But I do miss it, absolutely. I think all my friends miss it as well, who've flown to space. Everybody would like the opportunity to go
again. What do you miss?
I think it's a mixture of things. That, I mean, the professional element of being in an environment where you're just allowed to be focused on your job to such a high degree with no distractions. No one calls you, no one emails you. All you're doing is being the best that you possibly can be, and everyone's helping you to do that. I mean, there's nowhere on earth where you're working in an environment like that.
Yes.
The fact that every day you're touching experiments that might be people's life's work, and, you know, really feeling like you're contributing something back to society. So there's that element, and then there's the element of, well, just go to the cupola window and spend a couple of hours on a Sunday looking down on earth. There's that element that you miss as well.
Was it quite emotional being up there?
At times, yes. Yeah. You know, you've got plenty of time to allow yourself to become really detached and you know, isolated. But I never felt it in an unpleasant way. I felt it as a sense of calm, of kind of serenity, you know, having that time to reflect. I guess it is a bit like, you know, if you go on a holiday and you get that sense of just getting away from it all.
Yeah, but there's a beach or a ski slope. It's a bit different than being in space.
But it's the same feeling. It's that kind of ability to just unwind and detach yourself.
How incredible.
Yeah.
So you're quite good at meditating and mindfulness and everything now, do you think?
I don't do meditation. I like running, and I think that's where I get my meditation.
Which, so, you were running up there. We all watched you doing that as well. You did the marathon.
Yes, yeah.
In space.
I've always found that is the place. I never like running to music. I rarely even wear a watch when I run. I don't wear a heart rate monitor. I'm not interested in mileage and performance and timing. For me, running is about headspace. It's about
lovely,
getting into the rhythm and just enjoying that time to allow your mind to wander.
How did the whole becoming a, I hate the word, I'm just going to use it once, celebrity off the back of it? And it's a very odd status that you suddenly found yourself in. That, you know, I said to the family, oh, I'm going to speak to Tim Peake tomorrow. And they just looked, what? And it was different than when I say I'm talking to, you know, an actor or whatever. But that celebrity status and that wonder that you put out there, do you enjoy it? I get the feeling that you sort of do enjoy it all for the right reasons, not for the wrong reasons.
I mean, I enjoy what I do, and I enjoy talking about what I've done, and I love it when other people have the similar passion. So from that point of view, yes, I do. And I think I'm quite lucky that, you know, space is something that can really encapture emotions and people's desire to know more about it, and passion. So it's not a bad thing to be involved in. I think if you're known for being a politician, you're probably going to be having a harder time of it. And people who come up to me because they might recognize me, they generally, it's a positive experience. They want to, you know, speak to me about space and are very respectful. So I haven't had to, you know, experience the downsides of being a known person, really. I like to think that what I'm doing is helping to promote science and tech and, you know, STEM and kids and inspiration and
that's fantastic.
Good messaging as much as possible.
So what would you say to the child that wants to go into space, that it is possible?
Completely, yes. Yeah, and it's going to become more possible in the future. We're going to see more people fly into space with easier access to space, more space stations going up there and you know, a new program at the moment going back to the moon and a plan to go to Mars. So what's happening in the space industry right now is phenomenal. It really is rapidly expanding.
There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot when in the papers and on television and everywhere when everybody talks about very wealthy gentlemen who put their money into space exploration. How do you feel about all of that? Are they doing it for the same reasons as you want to see? I mean, like you said, that you might be able to save people's lives, and what a difference you're going to make.
There's all sorts of things happening. And part of the excitement of space is the fact that commercial companies are getting involved. So that's very disruptive. It means the cost of getting space is plummeting, which means you can do more and you can carry
more. So it's a good thing. So
in some respects, it can be a really good thing. And some things that we thought were science fiction are going to be reality in 5 years' time, you know, because Elon Musk's SpaceX Starship, which is coming up for its third launch very soon, when that's a success, it could be as cheap as $200 to get a kilogram to space. It used to be $57,000 on a space shuttle in 2011. So in a short space of time, that's what we're talking about. Oh. And Starship can carry 100 to 200 tons to low Earth orbit. Now you can start talking about manufacturing factories in space and solar farms in space, for example, that can beam down energy.
Solar farm, I like. Factories, yeah. Doing factories in space?
Well, manufacturing the things that we can't manufacture on Earth, or, you know, potentially server farms, which here on Earth, they're using vast amount of energy. They're using vast amounts of water to keep them cool. And as artificial intelligence becomes more prolific, we're going to need more processors, more server farms, more computing processing power. Well, potentially you can put all that in space where you've got permanent access to clean, limitless energy from the sun. You've got easy access to get rid of the heat out into the universe with very little impact on planet Earth. And so, you know, we need to get smarter. And so space will help us to do things that will help to protect the planet. But then we need to look after space. That's the flip side of the coin.
Yes.
We need to make sure we're all regulated, make sure that we're not polluting space, make sure that we're having a minimal impact on the climate in terms of getting to space and getting back. So there's a lot of people working on that as well, making it as clean and sustainable as possible.
Apologies now for asking you the question that I know everybody asks you, but do you feel differently about your life and about life on Earth and you as a soul and as a being? Do you feel differently about it all now?
I do, yes. Going to space just shifts your perspective in that respect. But it's something that I've kind of been thinking and moving towards all my life as well, in terms of I've always asked myself the big questions. And I'm always wondering, today,
I'm thinking,
isn't it crazy? I wrote a book, The Cosmic Diary of Our Incredible Universe, and it was aimed at kind of 9 to 12-year-olds. But actually, I've had so many adults say, this is brilliant.
It's a brilliant book.
It kind of does focuses on, you know, it's taken 13.8 billion years for the universe to create us. And as far as we know, flaws and all, the human species is the most complex intelligent species in the universe until we find otherwise. So let's respect for a minute what the universe has created in us. And we need to appreciate that and protect it. So I think we do need to look after ourselves. We do need to think, what is a universe without life? Well, it's pretty meaningless, really. It's just a lot of matter doing, you know, physics and not much else. So consciousness, life, love, hate, all these emotions, the things that we have as humans, we need to protect that. And so I do think of life differently. I see us as having had this journey. We are the consciousness of the universe.
And spiritually, whether it's, I'm not going into the religious side, I'm just talking spiritually, it must be very profound, suddenly feeling that deep in your soul, feeling those things spiritually. It must be extraordinary.
Yes, and some people do have a religious experience. If you had a predisposition to being a religious person beforehand, then it's going to probably strengthen that feeling of faith. But it is a spiritual experience, even if you're not a religious person. Mm. And it is very thought-provoking, you know, to be there as a human floating in a spacesuit, looking down on the cradle of life as we know it. It does kind of give you some thoughts about how did we get here and where are we going?
Yeah. It's interesting. I remember when you were doing all the lives into all the different TV shows, whether it was Blue Peter or, you know, you did so many chats when you were up there, and every child wanted to know about going to the loo.
Yeah.
I just, one of those things, and when I was looking at old video footage and the interviews, and everybody wanted to talk about the music that you'd chosen, which fantastic choice of music, and how you go to the loo.
Yeah.
And I love that that's how kids think, not what does it look like from space. How do you go to the loo?
It's always the basics, isn't it? But it's so important.
It's just so lovely that they still want to know that. Do they still ask you that? Do kids always ask you that?
They do still ask me. But what I found hilarious when I was researching for the tour and, you know, telling these incredible stories of astronauts throughout history, I didn't know something, and that's that Al Shepard, he was the first American to fly to space. He was obviously beaten by Yuri Gagarin, and Al Shepard never made it into orbit. It was a suborbital trajectory. But when he was sat on top of the Mercury Redstone rocket, there were a few problems and delays that they weren't anticipating. So they didn't think he was going to be sat in that rocket for so long before launching to space. And he said to the mission control, listen, I'm gonna have to relieve myself. What's the plan? And people looked at themselves and said, well, we haven't thought about this. So when a kid says, how do you go to the loo in space? Well, do you know what? NASA didn't even think of that before.
Poor
old Al Shepard had to relieve himself there and then in his spacesuit before launching up into space. So it's important. You know, the bodily functions are important. And we've learned a lot over the years. So now we just have to switch on a fan, and that airflow kind of takes care of everything.
Keeps
everything clean.
I'm very pleased you shared that. I like the fact that Ed is nodding behind you, who works on this. He's nodding. I hope that's not how you go to the loo here, no, on Earth. Or maybe it is. But the other thing that children were asking you as well, young people were asking you, was about food and all of those things. And I remember when I was a child, there was the space ice cream. Everybody thought, this is really cool, space ice cream. And we were told that that's what the people who'd gone onto the moon, that's what they'd eaten. And there's all of that. It's the simple wonders. And I love the way that kids look at space and look at all of that.
I know. It is incredible. I hate to burst people's bubbles, but the space ice cream thing, they flew it once on the space shuttle and it tasted so dreadful that the astronauts said, never fly that to space again. But I think they'd bought so much of it that NASA decided to flog it in the museum, and it did really well. And so they just kept on selling it.
That's so
and
funny.
So everyone thinks that we have this dehydrated, horrible cardboard ice cream. But no, it's not on board now.
I love that. So Tim, doing the tour that you're doing, and you've done books, you've done kids' books, you've done adult books, doing the tour that you're doing now, do you know what people want now? I mean, obviously you've done this interview probably 10,000 times, if not more. Do you know, like you said, you're now investigating the other astronauts who came before you. I remember meeting one on The Big Breakfast, Buzz Aldrin.
Oh, wow. He
came.
Yeah.
It was quite wow.
He's quite a character, yes.
Yeah. But do you know, are you able to feed people what they want now? This tour must be amazing. Mm. Just watching you on stage, I could spend. Apologies to your family. I think I want you to come and move in because I have so many questions. We haven't got time with this podcast.
I hope so. I mean, I really enjoy doing the My Journey to Space tour and really getting a feel for, you know, what the audience liked. And I also really enjoyed kind of sharing that story. So this, I thought, well, that's just my story. I mean, I've got more stories, but I've also, you know, there are so many other stories. The other 609 people who've made it to Earth orbit, and there are some incredible stories there, right from the early days to, you know, the four friends I've got who are preparing to fly to the moon.
Are you jealous of them?
everyone's jealous.
Aww.
Yeah, there's no point denying it, you know, but it's going to be great. It really is. And they're amazing people, and they're going to do us proud. And so can't wait for that mission next year. That's going to be a bit like Apollo 8 orbiting the moon. And then the next year after that, so 26, we'll be seeing boots on the moon again.
Do you not want to go?
Oh, I do, yeah.
Oh, you
do? No, absolutely.
But will you go? Will you go onto the moon?
I doubt that's going to happen in my career time frame for me.
Oh.
As in, there might be a chance of going back to the space station. I'm currently working with Axiom Space, an American company, and the UK Space Agency. We're trying to put together an all-UK mission.
Oh, I didn't know you were going back.
Well, the crew's not been announced, so it might not be, and I can't get too excited just yet.
Okay, but I can. I'm excited for you.
It's hard not to get excited, yeah. And it'll be a commercially sponsored mission, which would be really exciting for Brits and be great for our science community, great for engineering and tech and outreach. So if we can pull this off, it would be amazing.
Oh, well, good luck with that. I didn't know you were going to be doing that, but good luck. I think
from
your smile, it's a big possibility. But enjoy the tour on Earth first before you go back into space. And do you think you might go on to Mars? Would you be one of the people that went to Mars?
That's an interesting question. So at the moment, I'm not sure it will happen again in my career time frame. Right now, I wouldn't do it because I've got a 15-year-old and a 12-year-old. And it's a 3-year mission. And that's not the time right now to be away.
Of course.
But once they've left home, once they're doing their thing and enjoying themselves, then why not? So it's interesting, actually. And I was thinking to myself, I wonder if, you know, what the potential could be, what the age limits could be. And there are 4 people on board the space station right now who are older than me. And one of the NASA astronauts who's about to fly, Don Pettit, who's a great guy, he's an amazing scientist, a brain the size of the universe. And he's 68, and he's going back for a 6-month tour to the space. So, you know,
Will you live longer than all of us now?
No, probably not.
No, but do you not live longer in space?
Well, it gets a bit complicated. Einstein's theory of special relativity and general relativity. So because you travel faster, time slows down a little bit. But because you're in a lower gravity environment, time speeds up a little bit. So they pretty much cancel themselves out. But special relativity wins by about 0.07 seconds. So I'm 0.07 seconds younger than when I left before I flew. So relative to somebody here on Earth, it's about that. So nothing significant, I'm afraid.
I'm sorry. To me, that's significant. Tim Peake, you are just completely a joy. So thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Gabby. It's been great.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.